The Bagthorpes gathered on the steps to wave good-bye to their visitors. "God bless," called Aunt Penelope magnanimously, as the car moved away round the first bend in the drive. "Keep your fingers crossed," Mr. Bagthorpe told everybody. "They're still in the drive yet. If Russell turns in, as they turn out, it will be a head-on job this time." They waited expectantly, but there was no bang. They let out long breaths of relief and looked at one another with sudden affection. There was nothing like a visit from the DB to reinforce their own family feeling, which was never otherwise noticeably strong. All of them, though they would not have admitted this in so many words, were feeling quite well disposed toward one another, and pleased to be the family they were. Even Mr. Bagthorpe was temporarily mellowed. "Well, thank God for that," he said, "if you will pardon the expression. They will not be back for a long time." Now that the family reunion was officially over, the junior Bagthorpes were in a position to concentrate their energies on more serious matters. They did not hold a meeting about these. They held meetings only while united against a common enemy. From now on, they would operate alone. They were after fame and immortality. They were about to scatter in the pursuit of these elusive goals when they were prevented by their mother. "Wait," she told them. They hung back impatiently. "There are the household chores to be done," she told them. "I've made my bed," William said. "And me," added Rosie. "All the household chores," said Mrs. Bagthorpe firmly. "Mrs. Fosdyke is evidently not well enough to come in today, and some of the responsibility must, I think, rest with you. She had an extremely trying day yesterday, and you are all partly to blame for this." "It's got nothing to do with that," Rosie objected. "It's her teeth. We haven't done anything to her teeth." "That may well be a psychosomatic symptom of her general malaise," Mrs. Bagthorpe told her. "It may well be that she will not recover for several days." "There may already be a letter in the post," said Mr. Bagthorpe, "giving in her notice. If she doesn't give it now, I fear she never will." "We will draw up a rota of household duties," Mrs. Bagthorpe continued, "and you yourself, Henry, will have a part to play." The atmosphere of general well-being and self-congratulation occasioned by the departure of the Latter-day Saints was fast dissipating. "There is no use my doing anything about the house," Mr. Bagthorpe told her. "With the best intentions in the world, I should break every electrical labor-saving device within the hour." This was probably true. He had a very long record of breaking things. He either broke them or misused them. On one occasion, he had been entrusted with loading the washing machine. He had used the hottest setting and included a brand new bath towel, so that everything emerged either shrunk or pale lime, or both. "I will certainly," he now conceded generously, "try to make as little work as possible for the rest of you." When Mrs. Bagthorpe made clear that this contribution was not acceptable, he followed the others gloomily into the kitchen to oversee the drawing up of the rota. There was still a good backlog of clearing up to do after the previous evening's debacle, in addition to the routine chores, and it soon became clear that there would be little time left for the pursuit of fame and immortality. "This family," observed William with perfect truth, "is always getting straight out of the fat and into the fire. It's all hail and farewell non-stop. I was going to see how long I could spend beating a tattoo non-stop today." "In that case," said Mr. Bagthorpe, "I suppose that the rest of us must count our blessings. Do not put me down for ironing, Laura, or indeed for anything to do with laundry." "When I do start my endurance tattoo," William said, "I shall need someone to keep bringing me food and liquids, and so forth. The existing record is held by someone from Michigan, and he beat for 320 hours. "If you start beating a non-stop tattoo," his father told him, "there will be no living soul left within a mile radius. I do not pretend to know why you should wish to embark on this course, but if you ever do, go somewhere a long way off and do it." "He's going to do it because he has an inordinate desire for personal aggrandizement," Tess said jealously. "I personally do not consider that a tattoo lasting even a full year would prove anything at all." She had, herself, already had the idea of an oboe-playing marathon, and was considerably put out to find that William had forestalled her. "As drudgery appears to be the order of the day," said Mr. Bagthorpe, "I suggest we get started. Where's Mother? What chores is she going to do?" Mrs. Bagthorpe hesitated. She had intended exempting both Grandma and Grandpa from duty. On the other hand, she did not wish to antagonize her husband, who, though without the remotest sense of justice in the ordinary sense, was a stickler for exact equality in this kind of situation. He was very poor in community spirit. Mrs. Bagthorpe did not herself feel quite up to what would probably be a difficult interview with a still semi-recumbent grandma. She accordingly sent Jack up, as being the one of her offspring least likely to ruffle Grandma's feelings. He was soon back. "She says she's busy," he announced. "Ha!" Things were playing straight into Mr. Bagthorpe's hands. "Busy, she says. If one were to believe Mother, she is never otherwise, even when asleep." This was true. Grandma did have this delusion that she was always busy, and that her life was a ceaseless round of duties and engagements. She would write in her diary the most trivial everyday occurrences, such as "go to hairdresser," and "finish reading The Way of All Flesh," and "telephone Daisy." These items were all numbered and listed, and gave the casual onlooker the impression that her life was indeed a jetting and frantic affair. "I doubt," Mr. Bagthorpe had once proclaimed, "whether the Prime Minister of England has a diary that looks like hers." Mrs. Bagthorpe tried to stick up for Grandma, saying that she was, after all, quite old, and that when you got to 75, perhaps things like purchasing a bar of fruit and nut chocolate and polishing one's nails did take on the dimensions of major engagements. "What she is busy doing," Mr. Bagthorpe now declared, "is contemplating that horrible dead cat of hers, and casting around for some life-shattering event that will unhinge us all, as did her last one. Whose idea was the family reunion? When Armageddon finally comes, it will be Mother who has arranged it." "You are exaggerating, Henry," his wife told him, without conviction. "I shall appoint myself to do the vacuuming," he said, "and my first act will be to go and vacuum Mother's room. I shall drive her thence." He departed before anyone could stop him. The rest of them stayed to be allotted tasks that would take them, so far as they could see, the rest of the day, even if thoroughly skimped. By mid-morning they assembled in the kitchen for refreshment, and threw themselves into chairs in attitudes of exhaustion. "We can't keep this up," William announced. "We'll have to get Fozzie back." "How?" inquired Tess. "Extract all her teeth, perhaps." "Psychology," William said. "We exert some psychology. Now, we all know that Fozzie is cussed." They did. They agreed. "You will have also noticed," he went on, "that she gets really pleased if anyone butters her up. Look how she smirked when you took those photos of her with her food, Rosie. And look how chuffed she was yesterday when Mother toasted her." The others nodded. "Though I don't see how we're going to photograph her or toast her today," Jack objected. "Your trouble," William told him, "is that you are too literal. Mrs. Fosdyke will receive, within the hour, a large bunch of flowers and a box of chocolates. You go and pick some flowers, Rosie." She got up obediently. "And mind, Father doesn't see you," William warned. "What about the chocks?" Jack asked. "Will we all have to fork out?" "You haven't even got a memory," William told him. "There is already a large box of chocolates meant for Fozzie on the sideboard in the sitting room." "So there is." Jack recalled now a brief scene from the previous day. It had been a tame scene by yesterday's standards, hence possibly his difficulty in remembering it. Mr. Bagthorpe had walked into the sitting room during the morning, and seeing a large box of chocolates, picked it up, and started to pull off the cellophane. The crackling of this had drawn the attention of his wife. "Stop," she ordered. "Those chocolates are from Mrs. Fosdyke, from all of us, as a token of our appreciation. We shall give them to her straight after the party." "With teeth like hers," Mr. Bagthorpe replied, "I can hardly think of a less tactful gift. And I've pulled the cellophane off now." "Never mind," his wife said. "The chocolates are still intact, Put them down, Henry. Nobody ever gives me tokens of appreciation, he said, and put them down with an ill grace. So we'll take them down to her, William told the others, and hope to heaven that awful stink hasn't got into them. You can take them, Jack. Fozzie likes you best. Do you think she does? Jack was unaware that William was subjecting him to the same buttering-up treatment as that being used on Mrs. Fosdyke herself. All right, I can take Zero. He needs a walk. I'm sure Father's deliberately pushing the vacuum at him. He set off accordingly some minutes later, bearing a large bouquet of flowers, cunningly wrapped in cellophane, to give the impression that it had been removed from the chocolate box for this purpose, and the chocolates themselves. Come on, old chap, he told Zero as they reached the edge of the meadow. I'm on an important mission, and you are as well, very important. We've been entrusted with it, Zero, old chap. Good boy, good boy. And so the pair of them went happily and unwittingly from the fat to the fire.